This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today I'm going back to Bond with Spectre. I'm going to be talking about the Peanuts movie, Miss You Already, and Suffragette. There will also be some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course the world-famous home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
There's a couple smaller news stories I want to hit before I get to the big one. First one is about the Muppets, and of course, I've been talking a lot about TV lately, even though I really don't cover it, but I find it interesting that it's being talked about that the Muppets are going to be getting sort of what's called a soft reboot, which kind of retools the show. It doesn't, like, shut everything down and start fresh. It sort of just retools it as it's rolling, you know, changing its horse in mid-stride. One of the things with the Muppets is it came under fire earlier this year, and I talked about it on the show, about it being too grown-up, too adult for kids. I've always sort of dispelled that because I've said the Muppets have always been about grown-up humor masquerading as little kids' characters. And while the Muppets connect with kids because they're puppets, you know, they're soft and fuzzy, but the Muppets have always had a certain level of transgressive humor in what they do. I mean, there was an episode a couple weeks ago of the Muppets where they all went out to do karaoke with Miss Piggy after the show wrapped, and they all got drunk is essentially what happened. I didn't have a problem with that because this is the Muppets. The Muppets have always been real people as puppets. And while I've enjoyed the Muppets, the numbers have declined a bit from its premiere, which is always happens. And anybody in network TV should understand that a buzzed about pilot is going to get a lot of viewers in its premiere, and then it's going to decline a bit. But I think they're talking about retooling the Muppets to be closer to what they used to be. Bill Prady, who was sort of spearheading this type of show, has exited, and I don't think it's a bad thing that they're retooling the Muppets. I don't know if this format would have lasted. I mean, it is a bit of a spoof of The Office. I think it would have worked as a one-shot series, you know, maybe just one season. And actually, I think it would have been cool if they would have gone sort of the American Horror Story route and done Muppets as this mockumentary, and then the next year do a different version of the Muppets, kind of make it a different movie each time out. So I'm okay with seeing a retooled Muppets. I just don't want to see them lose their edge, which they got back. The next piece of news is probably the biggest, one of the most controversial, and this one is about Quentin Tarantino and his row he's having with the police, the Fraternal Order of Police in particular, the union. The background of this, Tarantino, at the end of October, went to a rally against police brutality. Tarantino, in the middle of this rally, made some pretty caustic comments, calling some police officers murderers and the actions that they do murder. And the police unions, rightfully so, are going to be taking issue with that. And he has come out and made it clear, I'm not talking about all police officers, but there are some that are doing this. Here's where I think the FPO, the Fraternal Order of Police, is not doing itself any favors. They've come out and said, quote, Tarantino has made a good living out of violence and surprise. Our officers make a living trying to stop violence, but surprise is not out of the question. The FPO has come out and essentially said, we've got a surprise waiting for you. And it might happen between now and the premiere of your new film, Hateful Eight. They've called for the boycott. Look, I don't care if they call for a boycott. That's the way the world works. Boycotting films is a way of life, and people do it. The thing that's silly about the FPO calling for a boycott of the Hateful Eight is Tarantino's fan base has never been what you'd call a diehard conservative fan base. It's always been edgy. It's always been into exploitation films. It's always been more art house and liberal. And that's just the kind of audience he gets. So a boycott from the FPO for Hateful Eight isn't going to do anything. That's not his target market. As opposed to when, like, the Dixie Chicks came out and said something about George W. Bush during wartime and spoke out about the president on foreign soil, they didn't realize that a lot of their fan base and their audience was of the conservative mindset. What bothers me about this whole situation is the FPO is just not making themselves look good. It is a bad idea to respond to allegations of abuse of power and bullying by implying you're going to abuse power and bully. Whether or not anything happens, the union should not be out there making threats. And this is a threat. You could say, well, that's not a credible threat. But you don't publicly go out there and threaten a private citizen for exercising his First Amendment rights. I'm fine, call for a boycott. That's great. But saying, well, we're going to, we've got something in store for you, well, that just reeks of revenge. And that's not, you're not taking the higher ground. And I think that goes to the core of the problem. Tarantino could have chosen his words better. Absolutely. But overreacting like this is not a good thing either. And it reminds me of this old Peanuts cartoon where Lucy was saying, I'm a nice person, and I am paraphrasing here, but, and people are saying, no, you're kind of a bully. And she's like, take that back or I'm going to punch you in the face. That is not how you handle being accused of being a bully. And that's where I think this is going to shake down. And by the, ultimately, the FPO doesn't realize all they're doing is just giving more and more press to Tarantino. And his fans are going to be more and more in support of him. And it's just making more and more people aware of Hateful Eight. Whereas this one could have flown a little more under the radar at Christmas because there's so many movies that it's competing with. And it's just getting sort of like more fringe coverage. Now it's getting nationwide mainstream coverage. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to touch on is Anomalisa, which opens on December 30th. It's the new Charlie Kaufman film.
What is it to be human? What is it to ache? What is it to be alive? Each person you speak to has had a day. Some of the days have been good, some bad. Remember, there is someone out there for everyone. I think you're extraordinary.
Why?
I don't know yet. It's just obvious to me that you are.
It's really hard to see what this is because we're the radio and you can't actually see the trailer. I encourage you to go out and find this trailer and watch it on YouTube or wherever. I love Charlie Kaufman. He's done some incredibly bizarre but innovative things with like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. More specifically, I love Being John Malkovich and Adaptation. These were truly wholly original stories that you don't get in Hollywood. It wasn't an archetype. It wasn't a franchise film. It was something very different. And Anomalisa is this weird stop motion, almost realistic looking, but not quite mix of animation. And it looks brilliant. I love Charlie Kaufman stuff. And the fact that he's got somebody else co-directing with him, I think is going to ground the film a little bit more. I'm really looking forward to this one. This is the kind of film that makes me excited for award season. The next one I want to talk about is Alice Through the Looking Glass, opens May 27th.
You've been gone too long, Alice. There are matters which might benefit from your attention.
And in our darkest hour, before my final rhyme, will come back home to Wonderland and turn back the hands of time.
Time is a he.
He is not someone you want as your enemy.
Please, sir, the Hatter is in danger.
This is, of course, the sequel to the wildly popular smash hit Alice in Wonderland by Tim Burton. And it looks very similar. He's not directing it, but he's producing it. And it looks like it's got everything back in place. It's got the same production design and the same actors. And this looks like it might be a very innovative film. I've always loved the idea of exploring the universe that Lewis Carroll created because it's sort of this dark version of Oz. And even though Disney has now done both, this looks amazing. The thing I'm wondering that's going to happen, I don't know if this is going to be the monster hit that Alice in Wonderland was. Alice in Wonderland kind of was an anomaly. There's nothing you can point to that says that was going to be a huge hit, and there's a reason why it made like $115 million its opening weekend. It was ridiculously successful. I think this is the essence of creating lightning in a bottle. It's opening Memorial Day weekend, but it's going to disappoint because it's going to be so hard to match what the first one did because I think it was an anomaly, and that's going to be unfortunate, because I think this is probably going to be the better film. And that's it for the trailers. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Peanuts movie and Suffragette. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies rolling into the movie reviews. Let's start off with the kids' film, The Peanuts Movie. Charles Schulz's classic comic strip characters come to life in a 3D computer animated story about Charlie Brown trying to impress the redheaded girl next door.
I'm going to change who I am and become a winner.
Wow.
If there's one person you want by your side at a moment like this, it's your loyal dog.
No dog! If you really want to impress people, you need to show them you're a winner.
All I do is win, win.
Of course, when I say you, you know I don't mean you personally.
Step one, forget everything you ever knew about yourself.
Charlie Brown is not a quitter. Are you serious?
What's interesting about this movie is it's gotten a lot of notice in terms of social media. They had this little thing, this peanutize yourself. And I did a version of Peanuts, but the problem is there's no beard. So I ended up looking pretty much like Charlie Brown. A fat Charlie Brown is basically what I look like. A lot of times I'll get into making the little avatars of myself, but the Peanuts one, like I said, I just look like Charlie Brown. With glasses. But this has gotten a lot of buzz within sort of a grassroots marketing, and it's gotten a lot of advertisement. But it's funny, they didn't screen this one early, and I don't know why. They screen this late. A lot of times, if you, just a little bit of inside baseball with how movie journalism works, is they'll screen like a kid's movie at like 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning the week before it opens. And that's so you can take kids out of, you know, they're not in school. They'll show those in the morning because, you know, doing a 7:30 show for a 5-year-old is a little late for some families. So they did late screenings of this. They did limited screenings. I actually had to go out of town to see it. And I don't understand why. They should have been championing this thing. This is an adorable movie. And it's really grown on me since I just saw it this week. It captures exactly the essence of Peanuts that we've all grown up loving. I read the comic strips when I was a kid, and I still do. I still have a couple old books. I love the really, really old comic strips, like from the 50s. I think those are really charming. But once they got in the late 50s, they started doing the TV specials. They started out with Christmas Time, and they've done The Great Pumpkin, and they did Easter Beagle. There's a whole slew of these cartoons, and not all of them are great. So there's about 5 or 6 that everybody remembers as being charming and wonderful, and then they made a whole bunch more that are range from mediocre to terrible, and some of them are pretty cute and just hidden gems. But Peanuts is a timeless type of character. I mean, they're kids, and there's a timelessness with kids. They don't need cell phones or modern technology to really make it connect to children. My son, who's 7, is a huge fan of Peanuts, and he watches the series. And we've got these old Peanuts DVDs that he watched. And he was the first one to tell me, I want to see the Peanuts movie. And that says something for how they marketed it to the younger generation, because he's 7. He sees limited advertising, and they targeted it to what he would see. And one of the dangers, whenever you take a property like this, is that Hollywood will get its hands on it and say, oh, this is great, it's so popular and everyone loves it, but I need to put my own special spin on it. And they get some egomaniacal director to come in and say, I'm going to make it my own. This is not going to be your parents' Peanuts. This is going to be a new version. It's going to be edgy. It's going to be hip. It's going to be different. They weren't allowed to do that with this. And that's great, because this is your parents' Peanuts movie. This captures the heart and soul and charm and the characters that we have all seen over the years. In fact, if there's any real criticism I have of this movie, it's that it plays a bit to its own canon a little too much. They reference The Great Pumpkin. They reference the caroling and the Christmas Time special. They almost put too many references in. It's a great little Easter egg thing, but they almost go a little too far on it. I don't think they really do. it's not just some rudimentary animation. You look back at like the Christmas time episode, which was the very first Peanuts special. The animation wasn't terribly sophisticated back then. Not only were they doing it as cell animation, but it wasn't a high budget. And they allow themselves to play around in some pretty cool stuff because they've got all the imagination of Snoopy. They've got this whole Red Baron sequence that's amazing and really cool to watch, and it utilizes the 3D particularly well. But even when they got just the kids being the kids, talking about baseball or going to school and dealing with the Wawa teacher, they really give it some depth, and the backgrounds are very beautiful looking, and they go more from just that flat, rudimentary, very basic Peanuts background without losing the essence of what we see. It's a cute little movie. It's great for kids. It's great for adults who grew up with the Peanuts. And I think that is due in a large part to the fact that the Schultz family was heavily involved in this from the beginning. You can tell they weren't going to let them change and pillage the source material. They made it like a good old-fashioned Peanuts movie. And I think it's a great little G-rated movie, too. A lot of people forget that it's G-rated. You don't want a PG-13 Peanuts movie. I don't even know if you need a PG Peanuts movie. You don't even need bathroom humor or burping or anything like that in this film. This is the kind of stuff that gets a PG rating nowadays. It's just a wholesome, sweet little family flick. So, you know, gosh, I'm going to have to say the Peanuts movie totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Suffragette. In this film, Carey Mulligan stars as a British woman in 1912 who takes up the fight to win the right of women to vote.
You work at the laundry?
Part-time from when I was 7, full-time from when I was 12.
We meet Mondays and Thursdays if you're interested.
You a suffragette, Mrs. Elliot?
I consider myself more of a soldier.
As Mrs. Pankhurst says, it's deeds, not words, that will get us the vote.
We've identified weaknesses in their ranks. We're hoping one of them will break.
This is a deliberate escalation. This has to stop.
One of the things that makes this movie kind of amazing is not the movie itself, but just sort of the subject matter. It's only been about 100 years, sometimes less for some countries, including America, that women have had the right to vote. That just seems like a no-brainer today of like, well, of course women should have the right to vote because they're people and they're human beings. And we live in a society that grants every person, one vote. There's always been a struggle for voting rights. And this is a little bit different than movies like Selma last year, which is dealing with African-American. And while they have the right to vote, the accessibility of the vote, this is just the plain old right to vote. It also takes place in Britain, which is where a lot of the suffragette movement had gotten a lot of traction in the early part of the 20th century. But that's the reality. We're not that far from some really terrible concepts that pervade our society. With that said, this is really heavy-handed. Every single man that Carey Mulligan's character faces in this movie is a horrible person. Just the biggest sexist, horrible, nasty people. And there's one male character that's even remotely close to being good. And it gets just very heavy-handed that way. And it gets very preachy at times. And it overdoes the, let's make this all very drab and gray for the emotions. I mean, almost to a point where it becomes ridiculous. Unlike Bridge of Spies, which played with the color palette quite a bit, when they were in East Germany, it was dark and cold and gray, and when they were in New York, it was nice and colorful and vibrant. This one overplays it. The other problem is, they were blowing up mailboxes and throwing rocks through windows and taking down electrical grids at a time where it wasn't just a flip of the switch to fix our electric grid. That's really hard to frame that without making them look like terrorists. Imagine if the gay rights activists who were pushing for gay marriage, whenever they had a stumble or a defeat, if they started blowing things up, you would have lost a lot of public sympathy for them. And it's hard to frame this in that context, even though it's realistic and true to some history, it doesn't frame it very well and showing it at the last vestiges of a desperate movement. So there are some stumbles in this. So ultimately, even though it has a good intentions, I'm going to have to say that Suffragette kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for these reviews. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Spectre and Miss You Already. Let the sky fall.
When it crumbles, we will stand.
There is something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Carr. Kevin Carr. One of the movies I'm going to be reviewing is the big movie for the weekend, the one that's causing the most buzz in Hollywood and in the mainstream media throughout the land. Is Spectre. This is the 24th outing for James Bond 007 through Eon Productions. We're not going to talk about the original Casino Royale from the 60s or Never Say Never Again, which was a remake of Thunderball in the 80s. Those are non-canon. This is the 24th James Bond movie in the actual series. James Bond is back, and this time he's investigating an overbearing evil organization bent on gathering information on the entire world.
So what's going on, James? They say you're finished.
What do you think?
I think you're just getting started.
Tell me where he is.
He's everywhere.
This organization. Do you know what it's called?
Its name is Spectre.
And you know who links them all?
Me.
It's no secret my love of the James Bond franchise. I have loved all the movies. I had a conversation with a critic friend of mine. I had said, oh yeah, I love them. There's only two movies of all the James Bond films. There's only two of them that I think are just not good movies. That tip and that needle going into the kind of sucks or lower territory. And that's on Her Majesty's Secret Service, which I know a lot of people love that because it goes a little bit more into Bond's character, and you got Diana Rigg's story, and he kind of falls in love and he wants to quit the business. And that's very charming, and she's very charming, but it's too long. It's like 2.5 hours, and George Lazenby makes a lousy Bond, and Telly Savalas makes a lousy Blofeld. And it's so steeped in the sexual revolution, it gets corny and silly and stupid because he's out there literally going from room to room in this lodge having sex with these women. It just becomes a joke at that point. It takes the promiscuity of his character and just makes it a punchline. But even then, you know, there's still some great stunts in that movie, and you know, it's got the gadgetry, it's got all the stuff that makes Bond Bond. And the other one I didn't like was Diamonds Are Forever, which is the one that made right after that, and they brought back Sean Connery, and he's too old. You can tell he's just phoning his performance in, and it's very goofy 70s. But even then, it has some great parts to it. Every Bond movie has some good action scenes to it, and every Bond movie has some very fun moments. This is coming off of Skyfall. Skyfall was so popular and did so well in the global box office that it made almost twice what any other previous Bond film had, dollar to dollar. I mean, Skyfall was the Avengers of the James Bond films. It was an unprecedented success. So if you're going out there expecting Spectre to make the same money that Skyfall did, it may not, because Skyfall was an aberration. I don't think Skyfall was the new normal, although you do have a lot of the global box office to take into account. But as a Bond movie, Bond movies generally had a really consistent about, you know, $150 million to $200 million over the last 10, 15 years. And even movies like Quantum of Solace and Casino Royale, when they had rebooted them, they were kind of in that ballpark, and Skyfall was just something special. Spectre is not Skyfall. There's parts of it that feel like Skyfall, and the fact that you've got Sam Mendes directing, you've got Daniel Craig as James Bond. It's an IMAX release. It's the second time they've done an IMAX release of Bond. And it has some great stunts. It has some beautiful camera work and cinematography. Actually, the best part of this movie is the look of the film. That's the thing that makes it really stay classy. Now, with that said, it has some real problems. The theme song is so prophetic. It's got a terrible theme. It's Smith's The Writing's on the Wall, and it's terrible. And I remember when they showed the movie in our press screening, they showed the music video for the song before the film, and I'm like, well, this is silly, because if you really hate the song, you're going to hear it in 5 minutes after the opening sequence. And I mean, it works a little bit in the opening sequence, but as a song, it's, again, you're going against Adele doing Skyfall, which was so amazing. And as good as it looks and as beautiful it is as it is, it stumbles. And part of the problem is it stumbles. I've heard people, I think the biggest thing that's going to happen with this movie is there's going to be a big debate raging about why Spectre isn't as good as the other movies. And a lot of, I've heard people say, well, it's because it went back to the 60s and those are boring films. Oh, no, 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 no. Go watch From Russia with Love. That's a great movie. Dr. No's really cool. Goldfinger and Thunderball are two of the most quintessential Bond movies you're going to get. So the 60s were the heyday of Bond, and it goes back to some of that. But it doesn't quite do it as well as it could. It tries to go back to what the old school Bond was, but at the same time, it's trying to give the depth and the interconnectivity of Skyfall. And here's the problem. When you start developing James Bond too much, you don't end up with James Bond. It worked in Casino Royale because he's new and he's young. And then he gets betrayed, and that's when he becomes the cold, heartless assassin. But you want James Bond to be the alcoholic, womanizing assassin that he is, the guy who has no remorse, and he's a license to kill, and he kills without remorse at all. You want that. And if he grows too much as a character, you don't get that. And that's the problem with this new wave of Bond, where they're trying to make his character grow too much, and they're trying to tie him together with too much. Whereas in the classic Bond movies, he just kind of comes in, he does a spy thing for this one job to stop these guys from doing something crazy, and he moves on. You know, the Man with the Golden Gun was not his childhood best friend, or Goldfinger was not his cousin. That makes it kind of cool for one movie, but it kind of pollutes the timeline if you do that too much, and they're in danger of doing that a lot with the Bond movies. And that's what's coming to fruition with this movie. Now, with that said, it has a gorgeous opening sequence, a really cool opening sequence, with a certain part of moral relativism that I don't think ever gets addressed in the film, which probably needed to be. I'm not going to go much more into it because that's starting to get into spoiler territory. But I don't know how it cost $300 million. You know, I mean, a movie like Avengers Age of Ultron, you know where all the money went on that one. It probably cost $150 million just to get people to show up on set. This one, you probably had a big paycheck for Daniel Craig, and Christoph Waltz probably got a certain amount of money, but aside from that, if you like James Bond, it's a completely acceptable James Bond movie. It's not a bad film. It runs a bit long. It's 2.5 hours, and that's dangerous because any movie needs to have an excuse to be that long, and I don't quite think Spectre makes that excuse. It's still a good movie. It's still worth seeing, and it's still fun. But it's kind of like Avengers Age of Ultron compared to Avengers, or Star Trek Into Darkness compared to Star Trek. So even with all its foibles, Spectre kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Miss You Already. I'm almost out of time, but let's just squeeze this one in really quickly. Two women who have been friends since childhood struggle with emotion and life as one of them discovers she has advanced breast cancer.
Hi.
Hey. What are you up to at lunchtime?
Is everything okay?
You found out a week ago?
Well, how could the tumor have gotten so big?
Because it's aggressive, like you.
The lovely nurse puts chemotherapy into the IV drip. And the medicine is like an army of soldiers. And they all march into mummy's body.
Jess, you should tell her.
I just don't want to rub it in that my life is great right now.
If another person looks at me with sad eyes, I am going to projectile vomit.
This one stars Drew Barrymore and Toni Collette, and the most significant thing I felt was it was directed by Catherine Hardwicke, who is the woman who directed the first Twilight movie, and that got dumped from the series. She established everything, and then they got rid of her. I'm not a fan of Catherine Hardwicke's film. I've not seen 13, but I've seen, like, Twilight, and I've seen, didn't she do one of the Lords of Dogtown movies? She's done a lot of films I've particularly not liked. Thought she was a great, like, production designer when that's what she was doing, making movies like Tombstone, but I've never felt her as a strong director. I think it's nice that she went back to something a little more intimate than after the big blockbuster success of something like Twilight, but I think she does a fine job with this. This isn't really my kind of movie. I had some radio people I work with are like, chick flick. Well, you can't dismiss it as a chick flick. It's really more a cancer movie is what it is. It's people dealing with the emotion of this, and yeah, it's about women, but it's about cancer and the toll and the emotional toll that takes on everybody. So it works in that respect. It actually really picks up near the end and becomes very charming and sweet. But yeah, I mean, you are dealing with all the stuff you'd expect from a cancer movie, with the horrible things you got to deal with chemotherapy and the stress and the emotion and losing loved ones. And actually, the acting's pretty good. I mean, Toni Collette, for as terrible of a character as she played, because the character's not the nicest person, she does a good job in it, and she's at least warm in that process. Drew Barrymore's very good in it. Patty Constantine is Drew Barrymore's husband. He's very good. So it's a smaller, intimate movie, but if that's what you want to see because you don't want to go see Peanuts or James Bond, this one can work. So I'm going to have to say Miss You Already kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the movie reviews. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the box office, the home cinema roundup, and a little bit more about the history of James Bond. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's take a diversion from the reviews to talk about some Bond stuff, because I haven't done my little retrospective of Bond in 3 years, since the 50th anniversary for Skyfall 3 years ago. It's always good to talk about what my favorite Bond elements are. But before I get to that, I want to address something, and it deals with the box office, and it's about the Steve Jobs movie. And the question of it, whether it's a bomb or not, people are comparing it to Jobs. You know, have Steve Jobs is the Danny Boyle film, Jobs was the film in which Ashton Kutcher was playing Steve Jobs. Now, they've both made about the same amount of money at this point. And if you track the numbers, Steve Jobs is right around that $16 or so million that Jobs ended the national box office with. Now, is the Steve Jobs movie a bomb? No, it's not. And it definitively is not a bomb. Yes, it has not made its budget back, but I think by the time you're done with full domestic box office, full international box office, DVD rights, Blu-rays, broadcast, all that, it's going to eventually make its money back. Also, the difference is nobody thought about Jobs, the movie with Ashton Kutcher, much after it was released. And I think it was like an August or September release. Steve Jobs is still in line for some end of the year awards. Who knows? You might see Fassbender show up with acting accolades. You might see Danny Boyle show up with a directing nomination here or there. It's going to have legs. And if it gets some significant awards like a Golden Globe, a nomination or an Oscar nomination here or there, that's going to propel it. That's going to keep it in the box office. It's still going to be out there, and it might resurface a little bit after its initial run is over. Part of the reason it didn't do smashing is because to the just regular old audience, we already had a Steve Jobs movie and it wasn't very good. This is different than, say, in the 90s, when they had Deep Impact, which was a comet hitting the Earth movie, and then just a couple months later, you had Armageddon, which was an asteroid going to hit the Earth situation. But in this one, I don't think anyone was screaming for a Steve Jobs movie. And while Steve Jobs is far superior to Jobs, people just still saw it as a Steve Jobs movie. It's not exactly, I mean, people love the products in general that Steve Jobs pioneered. They just don't particularly want to see a movie about him. I think that's the bottom line. Also, if you look at the numbers, you say, well, in its number day of release, like, you know, 12th day of release or 16th day of release, it's made about the same amount. But see, Steve Jobs had a much shorter window to do that in because it was in very limited release, which did very well per screen. But the money it made in the full wide release, it's made more in a faster amount of time in wide release than Jobs did. They're very different movies, and just comparing them because they're about the same person is a fool's errand. That's it on Steve Jobs. But let's talk about James Bond. I always like to do a little bit of a Bond retrospective whenever there's a new Bond film out. And I remember back in 2002 when Die Another Day came out, everyone was looking back and saying it's the 40th year of Bond. And then in 2012 when Skyfall came out, everyone knew it was the Bond 50. And that was a big marketing thing of a lot of awareness. And that's one of the things that Spectre is going against, is it doesn't have that brand awareness. But I always like to look back and say what I liked about Bond. And I never say what's my favorite Bond film. You're not able to do that because this is a franchise that's spanned over 50 years. I mean, you can't exactly compare Skyfall to Bond in his heyday with Goldfinger and From Russia with Love and Thunderball. I mean, they're very different films. It's, they're almost uncomparable. whenever there's a franchise that's really old, that's been around for many, many decades, to have somebody say, oh, well, I'm a huge fan. There's a film critic I used to have a lot of dealings with, and she once said to me that she was a Trekkie. Oh, I'm a Trekkie. I like Star Trek. And I'm like, what's your favorite TV show? Did you like the original? Did you like the movies? Oh, no, I only liked the J.J. Abrams Star Trek. And I'm like, well, they've only made one movie at that point. You can't say you're a Trek fan and have never really gotten into the old TV shows. There's so much there to then say you're just a Star Trek fan because you like J.J. Abrams' version. That's like if Force Awakens comes out and people say, oh, I'm a huge Star Wars fan. Well, did you like the original Star Wars? I never liked the original ones. It's okay to say you don't like the prequels because everyone says they don't like the prequels. But to say, well, I never really got into Empire Strikes Back. Well, then you're not a Star Wars fan. You like the new movie and maybe you like the cartoon that's on now. So when it comes to Bond, if you don't like Bond films, then don't say that the new film sucks. If all you liked was Skyfall, or if all you like is the Daniel Craig movies, but you never liked the old Bond movies, well, then you're really not a person to evaluate the Bond films. I like to say, instead of my favorite Bond film, I like to say my favorite actor Bond film. Like, my favorite Sean Connery film is From Russia with Love. I thought that one had the most cohesive story. It got a little cheeky after that, but that one I thought just was a great story and in essence a good film. Best Roger Moore film, I think, was a tie between The Spy Who Loved Me and For Your Eyes Only, because that he was still young enough to play Bond and he still worked as Bond. And those I thought felt most, those were really steeped in the Cold War. And For Your Eyes Only, I think, came out in 1981. For Your Eyes Only, that's what I grew up with. Best Dalton film, he only did two. The Living Daylights, I thought, was way better than License to Kill. The best Brosnan movie, I actually like Die Another Day. I know everyone says GoldenEye was better, and GoldenEye's a good movie. And Die Another Day is very cheeky and ridiculous, but I loved that sort of 40-year retrospective that they did with that film. And the Bronson films were always goofy anyways. My favorite Craig film still is Casino Royale. I still like Skyfall, but I thought Casino Royale was a better film. Ultimately, the best Bond villain is Blofeld. Not necessarily Blofeld from this movie, Spectre, but from Russia with Love, Thunderball, and You Only Live Twice. That's when they really made Blofeld who he was and what the character could be. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Was I correct last week? I said that Our Brand is Crisis is going to make $15 million. I was way off. Our Brand is Crisis made $3 million. Wow. This has been a terrible October for movies. With the exception of The Martian and Goosebumps, everything else has underperformed. I mean, Bridge of Spies did well, but last week the highest new release was Burnt with $5 million. Scout's Guide to the Apocalypse didn't even make $2 million. These are terrible numbers for movies. A lot of people say, oh, it's because The Martian's such a juggernaut. No, The Martian won with $11 or $12 million last weekend. It's not exactly a juggernaut. It wouldn't take much. It wouldn't take that good of a movie to beat The Martian at this point. It's just there hasn't been much competition out there. October has been a dip, has been a real dip. With the exception of The Martians and Goosebumps, you really don't have big movies. And even then, Goosebumps has done only about not even $60 million. Like I said last week, I think Our Brand is Crisis would have done a little bit better if it was farther into the presidential campaign. Right now, people aren't really worried about politics. They're just more annoyed with the debates going on both sides than they are interested in the actual nitty-gritty of politics. Next year would be a good time to release the political movies. This week, obviously, Spectre is going to win. I mean, Peanuts is going to do well, but Spectre is going to win. Even if it doesn't do well, Spectre's going to win. The Peanuts is probably good for in the upper 40s or 50 million, which is good for a November release and great for Peanuts. I mean, I'd love to see them make more Peanuts movies like this. I'd really look forward to that. But Spectre, people are saying that it's going to be in the 80s. I think they're hoping for a number similar to Skyfall, which I think Skyfall made like 88 million its first weekend. I don't think Spectre's going to come close to that. I actually think it's going to be in the 70s. There's a little bit of bad buzz coming out from Spectre, and a lot of people are saying it's terrible, it's a bad movie. It's not a bad movie, it's just not great. It's Quantum of Solace to Casino Royale, even though I've always liked Quantum of Solace. This is going to be like Avengers. Age of Ultron was less than Avengers. This is going to be like Star Trek Into Darkness was less than Star Trek. This is going to be the bounce back. I'm going to say $72 million just to make myself look like a genius in case it comes in that low. But it's still, Spectre's going to make money. It's already making tons of money overseas. And that's really where it's going to make its impact is the overseas money. Because it's a pretty looking film. And it's got some great action in it. And nobody cares about story once you get past that in the international box office. Otherwise, the Transformers movies wouldn't have done well at all. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the recently renamed but world-famous Home Cinema Roundup. The big one this week is Inside Out, the new Pixar movie that is coming out right before The Good Dinosaur later this month. So you're getting a double dose of Pixar. Inside Out's a charming, wonderful, great movie. Worth seeing. If you haven't, worth buying. It's something that you're going to watch with your kids over and over and over again. There's also Toy Story that Time Forgot, which is a short of Toy Story. I love these little Pixar shorts, and I love them continuing the characters. Toy Story is always charming. Bloodsucking Bastards, which I covered a couple months ago on this show. This is a movie about vampires in the workplace, and it's sort of like Office Space meets 30 Days of Night. Lots of fun. But real fun is Roar, which is that bonkers movie that Tippi Hedren and her husband made back in the early 80s about a house overrun with jungle cats, and they really shot it with real lions, and people were getting injured. I mean, Melanie Griffith, her daughter, was severely injured on set, and it's a mess of a movie. It's one of those movies that Drafthouse Films will go and recycle and find that was forgotten, then they re-release it as kind of a bizarre WTF type movie. There's also Vacation, which I was not a big fan of, but you know, it's out there. Ed Helms rebooting the Vacation franchise. The End of the Tour, which you should see showing up again in award season with Jason Segel and Jesse Eisenberg. A Lego Brickumentary, which is a neat little movie about Legos and their impact on society. If you missed that, that's out there. There's also Doctor Who Season 9 Part 1. You can catch up on this season of Doctor Who before the last half of the series rolls through into Christmas. And that's it. I need to leave for the week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about The 33, Love the Coopers, and My All-American. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.